This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I am J.A. Lovelock, a barrister, an author, but most importantly, a crime junkie. Welcome to my podcast, Behind the Yellow Tape.
In this episode of Behind the Yellow Tape, I speak with Gillian Gilsonen. And Jill has quite an experience of and in the criminal justice system. And she is here to tell us all about this experience. Hello, Jill, and welcome to the program. Now, we're going to get right into it in a moment, but let's start from the very beginning. Tell us about your background.
Hi, Joanna, thanks for having me. To go back a bit, so I grew up in a large family, single parent large family in North London. At the age of 18, I became a qualified nanny. I didn't do too good in school. I became a qualified nanny. I took myself to college and life was looking great. Unfortunately, in 2004, I would have been 23 and my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, which kind of turned everyone's world upside down. She had about a year to live. Subsequent to that, my mother passed away. We lost the family home that we were living in, all of us, all my siblings, and I ended up moving in with my partner at the time. I left my job. I couldn't cope with my job and my mum passing away at the same time. Obviously, working with children, I couldn't concentrate. I just couldn't do it. So I took myself away. Unfortunately, I did meet my ex at the time, moved in with him. A year later, ended up in a South American prison for trafficking drugs with my ex-partner then.
How did that come about?
I moved in with him. He actually had three young sons. Their mother had passed away some years back. So I joined their family. I became sort of mother, took them to school, fed them, just did everything as a mother did at such a young age. And I had it in me anyway as being a nanny, so it was second nature. And he had a lifestyle behind him that I wasn't aware of. So there were holidays. He was going on holidays, what I thought were holidays. I was back with the kids. And then there was a time where I was asked to go on the holiday. And we went on the holiday and we never came back.
Oh. So what happened?
My ex-partner was attempted to smuggle drugs from one country to another whilst with me. And in effect, it didn't work. So we were caught at Caracas Airport in Venezuela. I wasn't even sure where we were going. I knew we were going somewhere in Europe. And then later, obviously, we were there and it was a very, very muddled thing. I won't go into that. It was very muddled, but ended up getting taken to a prison on the Isla Margarita, which is just off of Venezuela. It's an island by itself and it's a prison. It's a man's prison.
Yeah. Can I ask you, so was this the first time you'd been on this holiday? This was the first time, was it?
Yeah, definitely. I've never actually had a holiday before that, a normal holiday. So I don't know what a normal, we come from quite a poor background. So we had holidays to the beach, but never abroad.
Nothing so exotic as going to Venezuela. No.
we were taken to the army barracks for a few days, and then we were taken to the prison, which was a man's prison, which held about 2,000 men to about 60 women. And that's where we stayed. It's kind of third world. We didn't have beds. We didn't have showers. We didn't have daily food, regular food. We needed to cook ourselves. We slept on the floor. We washed from buckets. And whatever whatever I did, I had to wash his clothes, cook for him and send it over. Just the way of life it is over there. Two years later, I mean, he put his hands up. He said there was nothing to do with me because there was nothing in my bags. There was nothing to do with me. But he put his hands up and said it was all, but that doesn't matter out there. That doesn't matter. So we were taken to court numerous times, 17 times, in fact, 17 times we were taken to their court and 17 times we were sent back to the prison. It's called a de ferio in what we say in England. What do we say in England? I don't know.
Did you have access to legal representatives? Did you have lawyers helping you?
I did at first. Yes, we had the English embassy come straight away. Well, within a few days of being in the prison. The funny thing was, whereas my partner was dual nationality, Spanish, but he was born in England, lived here his whole life. But where he had dual nationality, the Venezuelans only accept him as a Spanish person. So he had a Spanish consulate and I had the English consulate, which made it, you know, it worked out well in the end. But at the time it was like, wow, this is not right. It's not Spanish, it's English. You need to help us both. So I was kind of going against them, whereas they wouldn't help my partner at the time. Yeah. So I was still cloudy eyed. Yeah. Pink rose glasses, whatever. And in a place where I'd never seen before. I needed him next to me. He spoke the lingo. He spoke the language. Yeah. So yes, I had legal representation. I had a lovely Spanish lawyer, Maria, I still remember, Rodriguez. And she tried, but it doesn't matter. You can try all you like. And then two years later, eventually the judge saw us. And by then we knew that there's no point in me saying I'm not guilty because I would have got more time than my ex-partner.
Did you do 8 years?
I did 3.5 in Venezuela. And then 1.5 here.
Oh, right.
So 5 in all.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been more, but the way they work it out in Venezuela is because you can work within the prison because it's like a world in the prison, yeah? So you find a job, you cook, you clean, you make toys, you do whatever you can because there's cash flowing, yeah? Mm-hmm. In the prison, there's shop, like a little tuck shop, and you, if you wanted food, you'd have to rely on the locals to bring it in for you. Yep, so you had to befriend the locals, befriend the people in the prison, befriend them, the Venezuelans, to get your food brought in so you can eat.
So so did you have visitors? Did you have visitors in while you were there?
Well, this was the turning point. So the English consulate, he offered to repatriate me. But like I said previously, I was still angry that they wouldn't see my partner at the time as an English citizen as he was. Is, yeah, and every time he walked through past my ex-partner, he comes to me, brings my bits and bobs, and I just was so angry with that they and all my English consulates said, well, we can't do anything about it. It's the choice that the Venezuelans have made. All right, well, I'm not coming home. Fine. So I've got my head in. There's a thing out in Venezuela called Sacramento. It means you earn your way out of the prison. You work. You come back on the grounds at night. A little bit like we have here, you know.
Like an open prison sort of thing. Yeah.
So they have a little apartments outside the prison where are lax, a little bit more lax than the four walls of surrounding that ginormous prison that I was in. And I thought, you know what? And I, as I said, so I declined twice. And when we go back to, did I have a visitor? So on the third year, my sister and her partner and her young daughter that I'd never met, my niece, came to Venezuela and the visit was booked. And the minute I saw my sister, and because I'd shut myself off from normal way of life and adapted to their way of life. And that was it. You have to, otherwise you cannot survive. So you go with it. And I saw my sister and very cleverly, the consulate was very clever because they wasn't due that week. My sister was there for 2 weeks. My consulate was not due at all. I knew that because they come every 3 months. And my sister had visited me and gone. She'd visited me and gone. During that time, I remember being called, they'd call me Inglesia. English, yeah, that's how they shout, yeah? English, your consulate's here. I'm like, oh, he's not Jew. What's Barry doing here? And he sat me down in the garden and he said, I want to give you one more chance. to go home? Is it the third time? And I said, yes. I just said, yes. He said, are you sure? I said, just give me the paper and I'll sign it. You don't want to speak to Joe? No, I don't want to speak to Joe. I just want to sign that paper and I'll go home. Because see, if my family brought me back to reality, it's like, yeah, just wanted to go home. I said, so what happens before I sign it? I said, what happens when I go home? He said to me, well, you'll spend a few nights in Holloway prison. I was like, okay, that's fine. And then you'll be released and then so forth. Well, okay, that's fine. Because, but bearing in mind, I already had my plans. I don't know how you say it in English out there, but I had somebody who was guarantoring me the job, you know, being my guarantee. You see what I mean? I was nearly there.
Yeah.
To be able to get a little bit outside and what have you. So I was still thinking, right, I've built all this up now and I don't want to particularly go home to England and then be locked up again. That's not what I want. And because completely two different prison styles. I don't know which one is one or the other, but he promised me, he said, no, a few weeks. I said, okay, fine. And within 6 months I was brought home by Interpol. Mm,
mm-hmm. And then what happened next?
So I was brought, but actually they did take me to Caracas, to the mainland, for a couple of nights into a woman's prison. Ooh. Completely different.
Ooh.
Obviously. Another two different styles of prison, completely different.
Is that better or worse?
Do you know what? I think, to be honest with you, I think it was worse because there was no... I was used to being in 100 degrees all year round. We were just on the equator, yeah? Not the sort of sun you can sunbathe in. Too hot, yeah? Too hot. But we had greenery. We had a garden. We had places to sit if we wanted to be tranquil, if we wanted to be... do you know what I mean? We were just left to do our stuff. And the first prison I was in, the prisoners controlled the prison, not the guards.
Wow.
Yeah. So... the prisoners chose where I was in the man's prison. They chose what goes. They make the rules. We just had the soldiers on the you know, the towers on the outside.
Yeah.
But there weren't no prison guards. We had two lady guards for our bit, just to, you know, but that was it. The men ruled the prison. They were set in three gangs and there were three bosses and there was, you know, it was madness, crazy deaths all the time. It's not normal not to see someone die or. And, you know, and over there, when someone dies, you don't, there's no extra time for that person that committed the murder or this crime. The person would just get chucked into the mountains. Very, 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 very out there. So the Caracas ladies' prison was all manned, yeah? Officers everywhere, all closed in, and it was freezing, absolutely freezing. I don't know how the women did it because there's no heat in there. I don't know if it's just because I came from all that heat all that time, but no, it was cold. I remember they put me into a little room. I stayed there for two nights and I got all the stuff that I'd packed. I had it all out over me because it was absolutely freezing. They stole most of my clothes anyway, the officers.
Wow.
When Jenny came, my sister, she bought me loads of new stuff.
Yeah.
Nice clothes, some shoes, because I've been 3 years.
Yeah.
Only what I had in my holiday suitcase. So, and I'd lost so much weight, nothing fit me. You know, I used to be chubby, really chubby little young girl. And I went to 6 stone. When I came back to England, I was 6 stone.
Wow.
Then Interpol brought me back. They did. They took me to Holloway. They put me on the first night as unit, which was lovely. I had a bed, I had a carpet. Gorgeous, but I was still very, woof. You know, and it was snow. It was 2009, I think, and we had really bad snow here. Really, really bad snow. But that wasn't the point. I was still comfortable at Holloway. Anyway, 2 days later, I get the nom sheet under my door. Now, bearing in mind what Barry, the consulate, had told me, I didn't think I would be doing any extra time. And nom said, you've got another year and a half. No, sorry, two and a half years here in England.
Mm. Mm.
Well, I said, oh, well, that's right. I said, right, well, that's not what I was expecting. And then I remembered the work that I did in Venezuela, because when you do work, remember I said the work
yes,
I did
yeah.
do, every every 2 days you work in that prison, yeah, whether it be washing, cleaning, making toys, whatever, you get a day off your sentence.
Oh.
And I did that for 2 years. I worked. I washed, I cleaned.
Yeah.
I cooked. My ex-partner made toys, Disney toys out of wood, painted them, sold them on visits. Mm. You know, that's how we survived.
Yeah.
And so this I never ever thought would happen. Mm. But I said no, I worked out there. I said I can't remember what is it. I can't remember the word right now, Joyana, yeah? Because these words, they come and
that's
go,
okay.
Yeah?
That's all right, no worries.
But I earned that. I earned all my days off.
Mm.
So when Noms told me I had 2.5 years, I was like, no, I can't, that's just not right. I earned them days over there, and I want them to come back over here with me.
That's right.
If you're not going to let me out in a few weeks, fine. But I know that I've worked, and that's the law over there, and that will come back with me. And by God, within 5 weeks, I can't believe it, the system actually sent it over to England. And they took a year off my sentence.
Wow, good.
I can't believe when you see, if you saw the office in that prison, they could even send a fax. But it did, it came back and I got a year off. So I thought, right. And then after a few more days, I got moved to Downview, and that's where I started settling. And
right. So how long did you do in total?
So in total in England, so a year and a half.
A year and a half, okay.
Yeah. They were quite, when I got to Downview, I was pleased that it was a single cell, because I didn't really know how I was going to be with these people. I didn't know how I was going to act. Never been in a British jail. I didn't have no problems. I never had any problems in Venezuela. I'm an easygoing person anyway. So you have to just adapt to how people are. And I did. So when we moved to Downview, I was happy that I had my own room, because I was still adapting to this life. I had a lot of, well, I'd say I had quite a few health problems because of my the way I had eaten, my dietary over there.
Yeah.
So can you imagine when I'm eating things like, you know, potatoes now or toast and stuff like that, and I just got a little bit ill. That passed. The prison was really sympathetic towards me over here, being where I was. There was actually another girl in the in another wing, in the D wing, where they call it the privileged wing. And she was also in Venezuela. So they said, look, there's someone else here that's gone through the same thing as you. Would you like to speak to her? And I was like, not now, but, you know, I wasn't, that's my, whatever. She was actually from South Africa, and she'd never been to England, but due to her dual nationality, they sent her back to England. She'd never even been there. So, yeah. Anywho, very, very quickly, the prison put me to D wing, which was the resettlement wing. So very, very quickly, I was allowed out for day trips, which really, really helped. Really helped in the fact that I, like, hadn't seen, like, a street, cars, things like that. You know, like, it's just English life, you know, just normal life. Mm. So that went on. I started to volunteer in a cafeteria in one of the local areas by Downview. So then I would go out in the day, come back, go out in the day, come back. And eventually I actually got a job in the Holiday Inn in Sutton, which is the town next to Downview. And that was a paid job.
Oh, wow.
It was New Year's Eve. And bearing in mind this hotel, yeah, and we were doing bar work. And our curfew was 1 minute to midnight. We had a little bit of fun. We had one little drink each about 9 o'clock. And then we went back to, we wasn't drunk at all, but, you know, they did breathalyze us. Why? We didn't think they wouldn't. The girl in front of me, she went, oh no, that's mouthwash. And I said, you know what? Yeah, I had a drink. What else can I say? I'm not going to deny it. You've just been breathalyzed. So I was then in for adjudication New Year's Day.
Say, how did that impact on your sentence? What happened?
It didn't. I got adjudicated the next day. So I was up before the governor New Year's Day. During the evening, when I'd got back into my room, I'd written a long, long letter to the governor explaining, please do not let this hinder me. It was a silly little mistake. I put my hands up to it. I am so sorry. Like, it was like a two A4 pages. And I gave it quickly to one of the officers in the morning. I was like, please give that to the governor before I adjudicate. He must have read it. So I went before him. He said, right, well, you know, he couldn't give me special treatment. He had to take me off D wing. He had to set me off the privilege wing, put me on C block, which is the mains, yeah? Mm. I was like, all right, cool, I can do that. It's no problem. It's my fault. I made a mistake. Normally, if you're kicked off D wing, you ain't going back in a hurry.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Within 2 weeks, I was back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because I don't know. And anyway, didn't go back to the paid job. The boss of the Holiday Inn actually writ to the governor and apologised and said, I am so sorry. It was me that offered her the drink. She was a really hard worker. And even when she comes out of prison, she's got a job here if she wants it. So I thought that was really nice. And I think that helped as well, you know?
Yes, that's nice. Yeah.
Silly little mistake. Yeah. But yeah, so I did that. I got back onto D-Wing and just waited then for my release. And that's where release was coming closer and I had nowhere to live.
How did you meet Anis?
So obviously I was looking for the housing bit. I approached my own borough, and silly me, I didn't know this stuff at the time, but when I approached them, I called them and I called them when I'm doing my outwork. So lunchtime, I'll call them. Went through everything. I lived there my whole life. All my siblings were there, blah, blah, blah. Do you have any mental health issues? I'm like, at the time, no. What sexuality are you? Straight. Do you have any drug addictions? No. So basically, I ticked none of the boxes.
Oh.
I wasn't wise, and no one had said, well, but right. Then again, I was always honest and open anyway. So I didn't have any of them problems. And for that, I didn't even get a hostel, chance for a hostel within my life. So then I knew I was buggered then, and I started looking.
So, what, upon your release, where did authorities expect you to go?
Well, they didn't. It wasn't really their problem in their
eyes. Yeah, yeah.
No, it was just you have to go back on the bidding system.
Mm.
You know, that's all it was. I did try. I did do that, but didn't even have enough points to even bid. So it was just a useless exercise. I think I was actually thinking yesterday because I was the last woman to be housed upon release by Vision because there was no more funding.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And I was going leaning towards St. Giles.
Yeah.
And I was listening, like people say, oh, yeah, St. Giles will meet you at the gate. They'll put you in a, you know, a room and that, and then they'll help you find somewhere to live. Whereas I don't know. I can't. Do you know what? It all comes to me, but Vision, I don't know how Vision come across my path, but maybe because they're close by.
Mm.
I don't know. Mm. I've never met anyone connected to Anis. I'm just not sure. I'd have to think about that one, but they did, thank God. Mm. And I went with Vision.
Yeah.
And so I knew, and I hadn't really spoke. I'd spoke to my resettlement worker on the phone a few times, and I was like, it's not going to happen. And I'm really anxious now, thinking, you're not going to, as soon as I come out of here, you're not just going to find me a flat. That's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. How can that happen? They were like, just leave us, just, you know. I thought, all right, well, I'm coming out anyway, with or without accommodation. So I'm coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got to Vision Housing office up in Colshalton, met Anis, met my resettlement worker. They assisted me. This is all in one day before probably 5 o'clock. They assisted me with obtaining a loan for my rent in advance for my studio. It assisted me with that. Then we actually made our way down to North London. Tottenham is where my place was, already there, keys there, met the landlord, signed the tenancy agreement, then took me to the local housing in Tottenham, assisted me with the housing benefit forms, and then took me to the job centre, assisted me with that. Yeah. So like I say, that was a lot of assistance.
Good.
Imagine I didn't have it.
Yeah, good. So now you've been released and you've got a place to live?
Yep.
Have you got a job?
No. I haven't got a job. I really appreciated the offer of the manager in Sutton, but it would have been impossible for me to go back to London to Sutton. And obviously, I just come out of all jails, and I was just, whoa. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to see the kids growing. Just wanted to just, I don't know what I wanted to do, but I was doing it. So for about, Anise did mention to me, the founder of Vision, like she must have seen something in me. She said, look, get yourself sorted together and stuff like that. And if you want to come volunteer with us, you know, the position's here anytime. I was like, oh, that's lovely. It went straight over my head at the time because I was just in awe that I was out. I was free. Oh, they took me to probation as well. That's another thing. So a few months went by. I was starting to learn how to use, how to live on the money that we were given from the government. So I would just, you know, so that's was probably about £60 a week then, probably, maybe that. So making sure I've got my food, my bits, my bobs and that, and then I can get through one other week and another week. So I'm, now I'm looking for a job. Now I'm looking for a job. How you normally look for a job, yeah? So I'm doing everything the job center is telling me to do. Bearing in mind I was a nanny before, yeah? I couldn't, there's no point in me looking for a nanny job, yeah? No point. Although there are places out there that may assist you, but that's not, I'm not going to waste time. But right then and then, I wasn't going to go for all that. I just needed a job. So, you know, old-fashionedly, I was getting job application forms. Yeah, a lot. It's only been 10 years, but a lot has gone online right now. Back then, I was still getting application forms, requesting forms for the job. Or, and then it was like, do you have a criminal record box? I have to tick it. And you don't, and I never heard from anybody. But you know, in the old days in the job centre, these have like leaflets, yeah? Like little pamphlets. And every time you look for a job, you must mark down what you did, the outcome, the date, and so forth, or word of mouth, and you fill them in. And I was generally doing them. Half of them, like, I just, oh, yeah, blah, blah, because there's only so much jobs you can look for in one day, yeah? And no response, nothing from anybody. So I thought, okay, all right, just carried on about my life for another month or so. And then I think I needed some information of something. So I decided to call Vision Housing. And he said, where have you been? I said, well, I've just been here. She said, well, we've been trying to call you. I said, well, I changed my number. Cut long story short. She said, well, what are you still thinking about that volunteering for us? I was like, yes, let's do it. So they called me in, and at the time they're in Finsbury, they've just got a new little office in Finsbury Park, which is just a stone throw away from where I was living. So happy days. I went for the interview, got the job. So I was volunteering 3 days a week as a resettlement worker in North London, which was great. They gave me a fiver a day. That would do me lunch and my dinner, and I used to walk to work. So it was happy days, you know. Within a year, I was employed as a full-time resettlement worker.
Good.
They helped me with the transition between benefits and employment. I had no idea, you know, even though I was a nanny, when I was younger, I was earning like £22,000 a year at the age of 18. And that's like 22 years ago. So that's quite a lot of money and to be living at mum's. Mm. So I wasn't rich, but I didn't, and you're living with mum. So I didn't know we struggle, but not struggle like the way I did when I struggle right now. I've never struggled more in my life than I am right now, to be honest.
What have you learned from your experience? What's come out of it for you?
A few things. Never take anything for granted. Appreciate what you've got. Never judge anybody. Never judge no one if you have no clue. Open my eyes up. Being out there opened my eyes up to a lot of things, and then coming back with my eyes wide open just kept seeing more.
And how are you doing now?
Not so good. It went really, as I said, I got employed after a year. I was then promoted to senior resettlement worker. And it was kind of like the business was mine on the floor. She trusted me with her life, trusted me with her business. And, but due to it being a charity, the rents was getting higher and the office kept having to move and move and move and move. And in the end, 5 years down the line, they ended up in East Croydon. And the wage wasn't high because I was in it with my heart, not for the wage. And I couldn't manage it. My outgoings was more than me in goings. So I had to make that brave step and move on. But my jobs were only based on my jobs, you see. My next job was with a housing officer with estate agents I used to work in partnership with. That's how I got that job. And then my next job was based on my previous job. So in effect, Joanna, I never was brought in as a stranger and interviewed and got a job. I was brought in just because of me mm-hmm. and them knowing my background. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I've never got a job going in as a stranger with a criminal background and getting one or even getting an interview. I was extremely lucky, by the way, the chain of events. Now, two years, a year and a half now, I'm unemployed. Unfortunately, I had a little breakdown about a year and a half ago and I couldn't do it. I was working with vulnerable women from prison at the time. And it was just really hard. I couldn't do my personal life. I had a breakdown, ended up in hospital. So it was all, you know, and then I decided, okay, fine, I want to go back to work because I'm a worker, worked my whole life. So I thought something easy, you know. And then I went, I applied for this cleaning job, which is kind of self-employed. So you get to choose the areas, you get to choose your hours, but you're still working for a company. And when I filled out this form, there was a question, have you got a criminal record? And I said, yes, again. But I'll call in for an interview still. Mm-hmm. So I went in for the interview. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I went to two. I had to get into North London. There's two, they called one, and then they called back for the second interview. And I got the job. I started working.
Good.
My first house was a house down the road. It was a massive six-bedroom Victorian house. It took me 6 hours to clean it. I cleaned it within four. Poor, it's awful. He said, that's really, really great. He said, and don't worry. He said, I'll still pay you for the extra hours, whatever. I said, no problem. The money goes to the company and the money take their cut and then they pay you. I was doing fine.
Then what happened?
I got a call one day. Hey, Miss Gilsennan, we need you to come into the office. I was like, well, your office is in central London. It costs me money to go to your office. Can you not just please tell me over the telephone? Okay, so there's something we want to talk to you about. I said, what's that? And I get anxious and I think, well, I want to know No, it's best you come in. All right, we'll make an appointment. I said, no. Could you just tell me now, please? Because honestly, I just want to know now. You know, I'm not waiting around to know if I've been sacked or what I've done something wrong. So I know I've definitely done nothing wrong. She says, all right then, okay, fine. It turns out you've got a criminal record. I said, yeah. You asked me on the application, do I have a criminal record? I said, yes. You invited me for an interview twice and gave me the job. Well, I'm sorry. That's not. I said no. I filled in your application online, and the question was criminal record or not. I said yes, and you employed me. I said no. Well, this is wrong. I said something's very wrong here. So just staff are obviously doing their job. That's not professional. I ticked the box yes, and you still gave me the job, and now you're going to let me go for doing nothing wrong. And another thing also turned, as she said, we're going to see that was it. She said, a DBS come back. I said, DBS? I said, I don't recall you saying anything about DBS. I recall you asking me for £45 from my first wage to cover any breakages that may occur during cleaning. I said, fine. No, that £45 went on a basic DBS. I said, you know what? I've got an enhanced DBS I could have given you myself if you had said, if you'd have asked, if you'd have mentioned it. So I'm not happy with you. I'm not happy with this at all. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to let you go. I said, okay, that's fine. You're very unprofessional, very unprofessional. Cannot believe, and I know what professionalism is. Yeah, because I was brought up in an office. I was brought up to work professional, and that's not professional. And it really, really took me back. It really pumped me back down to the ground. I thought, if I can't even, nothing wrong with being a cleaner, but if I can't even clean, what other jobs are out there for me? And so I just thought, well, I can take this further or I'll just leave it. I didn't have the energy to take it further.
So how do you spend your time now?
Well, obviously, pandemic, we've all spent much time indoors.
Of course,
But now it's coming out and I'm starting to feel a little bit strange now because it's not lockdown anymore. It's getting easier. And I'm still feeling like I'm isolated, to be honest with you. That's how I feel right now. I don't know if it's just the day or it's the week, but I can feel everyone going back out there and doing the stuff, and I've got enough, I'm stuck here still.
So when we're out of lockdown, when according to the government's roadmap, will you be, because you do seem to me, you have a fighting spirit. So will you be going out there to find something that you'd want to do?
I want to go back into hotel work, actually, because that was, I enjoyed that and I know I'm good at it. And it's a nice job to be able to do your job, make sure you do it right. And then when you clock off, you clock off. You're not actually dealing with human beings, because I don't think I could actually do that again, because it's my own mental state. I don't think I have addressed what I've seen or what I've been through in my life. I've never addressed it. I've never kind of had any real, you know, therapy or counselling, because you just you know, get on with things, you know? But I just think it all came to a halt. So I think to myself, dealing with humans, I think it was just, I've done enough. Like, I can't, because I've got my own problems and something. So by doing that sort of work, I'm getting back out there. My confidence will come back. That's all I want. That's just all I want. Just go back into a normal kind of work life. And if I struggle, I struggle. But like this, I can't live. I can't live like this.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone could live like this.
Yeah. Well, Jill, it was great talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Join us on our next episode for more fascinating and interesting matters that go on behind the yellow tape. Till then, you can keep in touch by emailing info@btytpodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.